Thank you guys for joining us today in the studio. We've got Jeff Stuhr, one of my college football teammates for a year at UW-Whitewater, and then we've stayed in touch, and he ended up hopping from W-2 job into investing in some real estate across the state of Wisconsin or Midwest. I don't know all your guys' locations. I guess that's for you to share, but yeah, Jeff, thanks for being here, man.
Thanks so much, man. It's always great to hang out with you. You're someone I've enjoyed spending time around, someone I look up to in the real estate and business world, and I wanted to see your office, so
yeah,
great to be here.
Thanks for swinging by.
Appreciate it.
I appreciate you taking the time. So how do you go from being W-2? I mean, there's a lot of people that listen that, you know, or come to me on Instagram or Facebook, hey, what's the first step I should do? I don't really like my job, and it's paying me, you know, $80,000 to $120,000 a year, which seems to be the typical kind of range. How do I walk away from that type of money into the unknown, or how do I get started in real estate?
Yeah. I get that question quite a bit too, and I do feel like I'm pretty qualified to answer that. A lot of times, you know, I don't know if I'm the best person to, you know, answer certain questions, but that's one that's right down the fairway.
Well, you're the guest today, so you are the best.
Yeah, deal. So, you know, I didn't. I looked at it. Let's go back to, so when I was graduating college and I was done playing football, I had a season-ending injury my senior year, and so I broke my collarbone, and then I was like, well, shit, now I got to figure out, like, what I want to do. I had not really even considered real estate at that time, but there were certain things that happened in my life. Like, my dad worked a corporate job for, like, 28 years and then got laid off, like, one day, like, out of nowhere. And so that sort
of... How'd that affect you at that age that you were at then?
I was a junior in college.
Okay.
And
so you're out of the house.
Yeah, I was out of the house, but you know, and I was paying for my own school and stuff, so it didn't really affect me financially. I just kind of saw the fear and sort of saw, like, the constraints that it put on us, right? And I thought at the time, I was like, okay, I've got to figure out a plan and a solution here. And I started. I knew, well, at the time I graduated with just a general business degree. I mean, I tell people,
me
I
made,
yeah, you know, I majored in football, you know, girls and beer for the most part. And I did
intramural basketball.
Yeah. I play a lot of intramurals too. I did give it a lot of effort in some of the business classes, but a lot of the stuff was fluff and I just didn't care about it. And I was making money just working at a Menards in college. So
gotcha.
I was like going to football, you know, doing that full time, and then I'm like, you know, picking up hours because I wanted to have money. But you know, so I had an old football coach that he had moved on from coaching football. He actually super knowledgeable football guy. He was a GA under Urban Meyer at Bowling Green back in the day. So I wanted to play running back, and I played running back my whole life, like Justin. But then in high school, we moved to the spread offense because he was our head coach and took us to the state championship and everything, and he was just incredible. But he ran the spread offense, so I'm like, I got to play slot receiver now.
Oh, you played against? Did you play against Drew Herma at Brookfield Central?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, is that game?
Overtime.
That was Drew that fumbled
yes,
on the goal
was.
Line.
Yes,
sorry,
it was.
Drew, if you're listening, I know that still hurts.
Sorry, brother.
He was pissed. That sucked. I trained with him forever, so I was really close with him. But anyway.
Yeah, I love those Brook Central guys, and I knew the coach well then. But yeah, so that was a good game.
Jake Taylor,
but, yeah,
and then we played
yeah,
with that
oh,
way.
Yeah, exactly. Good times. I get chills thinking about that. But you know, so this coach, he had moved on, and he went and worked in med device sales, and he was like the regional sales manager for the whole Midwest. And so I graduated college. I didn't know exactly what I was going to do. You know, I knew he had a nice house and a nice big boat. And I was like, I kind of want one of those. And he basically said, you know, well, you know, he knew me really well since I was 12 years old or whatever. So he's like, you know, I think you should really get into sales. You're, talkative, charismatic. I don't know if talkative is the best word for sales, but, you know, you have empathy, you want to help people out, and you're very competitive. And so I'm like, okay, like, I want to get into sales. I started, like, trying to read everything I could about sales. Instead of, like, filling my mind watching film on football, I was like, I'm going to read sales books. And so there was a culmination of things that happened around that time where I was like, okay, I want to get a sales job.
Bring it a little closer, probably.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, sorry. You might have to remind me a couple times. No, you're good. It doesn't matter. We're on a roll.
We'll just keep that in, too.
Yeah, I love it.
Keep going.
So I got into sales and was just, and it was 100% commission. It was at Stryker. And so I was just grinding, trying
like hospital beds and
hospital right? beds and stretchers. Yeah. Exactly. So anytime I have to go to a hospital now, I'm like, I've sold that, I've sold that. And that's a grind, dude. It's capital equipment sales. Like, and I was 23 making, some months you'd make zero for 3 months straight.
And it's going to be tough getting started in that because it's relationship and it's like how often are new hospitals opening and you know, it's
for
it's
sure.
It's not like they're buying it every, like, not, the same hospital's not buying over and over again every single day.
No, it's like a 5-year cycle or 7-year cycle or even more sometimes. So you gotta. I had really good mentors there. Also, one of my biggest mentors was a guy that played quarterback at St. Norbert's. Like, so they have a lot of football guys there. It's a good, great culture for former athletes and military people. And that was kind of when I stumbled into Grant Cardone. I was reading all of his sales books, and then eventually he started talking about real estate.
What was, so hold that thought, and we'll pick it up on the Grant Cardone part, but what was the biggest thing, because obviously I had the sales background too, yep. So anyone that has a sales background kind of right out of college and then ends up having their own business or, you know platform for people to invest in, whatever, what skill or trade or what was the biggest thing that you learned and were able to take away from that first sales gig?
You know, I think 100% commission sales is really a great position to be in because it's really you eat what you kill. And I think in business, you have to kind of adopt that mindset too. Like no one's going to come in and save the day. No one's going to, you have to go out and be results oriented and make things happen. I also think I just learned, you know, you get better skills at pitching, you know, at negotiating, those are all things I tell people all the time, especially if they're not really, really numbers focused or they're not, you know, that sales is a great place to start in business. Even if you don't know exactly what you'd want to do or what business you want to build or buy. Yeah. You know, having a background in sales because as a business owner, like it falls on you to drive revenue for the company, right? So, if you can get the skills at doing that, especially in a 100% commission environment, which I know is what you did as well, and that's
network marketing, and that was Northwestern Mutual.
Yeah.
I mean, it forced me to pick up the phone,
mm-hmm.
and then so number one, pick up the phone over and over and over again, not get scared of no.
Yeah.
Rejection. Those are the two biggest things. Yeah, because it's like someone tells me Notre Dame, I'm like, all right, you know, next.
In the hospital sales world, like this is when now they have something called like rep tracks and they have like all this really sort of sophisticated stuff to kind of keep reps out of the hospital. So I would have the amount of times I've gotten told no at that job particularly was just insane. And I would have to find ways because like there would be certain departments that would be like, we really need new beds. We need new stretchers, whatever. I'd go through like the loading docks and I'd make friends with the guys that are like, you know, so I wouldn't go through the traditional route to get in like the main entrance of the hospital. I'd go through the loading docks. I had to make friends with them. Then I'd go, you know, find that department. I'd get lost in some of these bigger hospitals all the time. I'm like, I have no idea where I'm going. I'm clearly in a spot that is not like, you know, that's off limits. And you just have to find ways to be super resourceful. Rejection's a huge one, right?
Yeah, trespassing. You learn how to trespass.
Yeah, I learned how to trespass at that job. Be resourceful.
That's what you have to do, though. I mean, like doing like real estate, I mean, in a way,
yeah.
I tell people, like, in a way, you're almost a professional stalker.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because you got to, the moment I can figure out, okay, I'm interested in that address, well, I can reverse look up the LLC, find out the owner, now I can white page that owner,
yep.
Right? Through the white pages, there comes an address and there comes a phone number. I mean, I'm not doing anything with that. Well, we're sending mail to the address and stuff, I guess. But, you know, the phone number, we're calling and building our database off of, right? And it's no different than getting lost in the, you know, the stomach of the hospital, the bottom of the hospital.
It's a great, I mean, I tell people a lot of times that what I do now, even though it's, you know, it's full time in real estate, like it's very similar to things that I used to do in sales roles where I was trying to build up a region or a territory and you got to break some glass once in a while. You got to look outside the box and be resourceful and get comfortable, you know, that a no is not like an always a no. It's just maybe a not right now. And so I think the persistence that you learn in a sales role is invaluable.
Yeah. I got my ass kicked the first year out of college. I made like I don't know, between $11,000 and $20,000 or something.
Yeah, I think I made...
But what I realized is, okay, this is an investment. The no's that I'm getting now are going to become yeses. Yeah. And that's what happened. And then next year, it like quadrupled, and then it doubled, and then it, you know, and it just kept, it exponentially started growing at that point.
Exactly. And that's another great learning lesson too, that in business, right? Like if you are in business for yourself and you can learn how to be good at it, learn how to drive results, it exponentially grows versus someone that's like, I'm getting a 3% raise or a 5% raise every year, which would be, you know, high. And that's, you know,
reward.
Exactly. Everybody has their own path. So I don't blame anyone that is, you know, would rather work in more of a, what they might think is stable, you know, job. And that's totally fine. I have a lot of friends that do that and family and all that. I just knew I wanted more. I wanted to make a lot of money. And then I wanted to try to figure out the best way to place that money. And that's where I was saying before, there was a couple of different things that happened. Grant Cardone started talking about real estate and not just sales. So I started thinking, okay, like he was someone that I kind of gravitated towards. I didn't go to any of his, like the 10X events or anything like that, but I read a lot of his books. And then a buddy of mine, Adam McCarthy, who you know, he started buying real estate. And then I realized also my grandma had passed away, and I never really knew what she did or whatever, but her first husband died in a car accident, tragically. And I, you know, and then she married my grandpa. And what she did with the life insurance money was she bought 4 duplexes. And that was, and then she bought a couple more. And so my grandma was basically a landlord my whole life, and I never knew that. And then I'm like,
when'd you find that out?
When she died. I was like,
when she died?
I was like 24, and I'm like, huh. How come no one ever told me this?
Yeah, and
it was kind of, and that was right about the time I bought my first duplex later that year. And I'm like, it would have been great if I could have, like, they were all on the cross, but it would have been great if I would have known that at the time. But that's when all this stuff converged on me thinking, okay, so my dad lost his job. I started learning how to get good at sales, or trying to be good at the time. I don't think I was very good. And then, you know, I had a buddy that started buying real estate. I realized my grandma owned a lot of real estate, never worked a job. And I thought, okay, now I started making commission checks. So that first year I made 36K. The next year I made 102. I couldn't believe I cracked 100. I was here we go. I'm rich. I'm rich. And then it also taught me that, hey, I think
it was a lot more money then than it is now.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. But it taught me that, like you said, the exponential growth. I thought, okay, well, if I did 3X that, maybe I can 3X it again. Didn't quite work out like that, but as I started making commissions and I started stacking some money, I always did live below my means, and I still do. And I think that's very important for someone that would, you know, I wouldn't maybe been able to take the risks, leaving a stable, steady W-2 job where you can earn a lot of money. I wouldn't have been able to take those risks had I not, you know, lived below my means for the last 10 years, you know, so I'm 35 Absolutely. Now. And so I think the main thing for people, to bring it all the way back to that first question, is if you're in a W-2 role, I think, you know, live below your means, continue to try to figure out how you can increase your top line and earn more, and then find an avenue or a vehicle to park that capital that's going to grow for you while you're not working.
So how'd you find your first duplexes? What was that process like, and how'd you go about it? Were you scared?
I was too dumb to be scared at that point, and also the market, right? Like, so, like I said, I bought 2 duplexes.
Did you buy the 2 duplexes when you made 36,000 or 100?
100.
So the second year, second or third year out.
Second or third year out. And I wish I would have done more of that. Like that, looking back, I would have bought hell of a lot more. But you know, that's where I have to give a lot of credit to Adam. So he was just starting out. He had bought a bunch of properties already. He's a couple years older, and he was just going gangbusters buying them. And I'd known him, and I would catch up once in a while, and I'd be like, shit, this guy's got, you know, I was with him when he was buying his first duplex. I remember him negotiating his first duplex when I was literally right out of college, and I'm driving around with him. I don't even know what we were doing. And he was taking a call negotiating this duplex, and I'm like, huh. Maybe I need to start thinking about that. And then I talked to him 6 months later, and he had 8 units. And then I talked to him, and he was very, very, you know, it's that risk-reward thing. Like, he was willing to risk a lot then. And I don't think I was quite there. But I just got to a point where I started stacking, you know, at the time a down payment would be 20 grand. I was buying $100,000 duplexes.
Yeah.
But I bought a few of them, and then, you know, those turned into $250,000 duplexes, and that changed my life. At the time, I don't think I knew anything other than, you know, breaking down the numbers and thinking, okay, if I put 20 grand down, there was a lot of things I overlooked, you know.
Me too.
Yeah.
I would do that. I still do that sometimes. Yeah. I'm always learning something.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. I mean, and I just tell people the more properties you get, the more bigger of a portfolio you get, or the bigger your business is. It's like, it's not like problems go away. They just get bigger.
I mean, I've talked about this before. Yeah. It was the 88 unit that we bought. I did zero due diligence in 2016. I just bought it. We still own the property today.
Yeah.
We bought it for like $6 million. It's, I mean, I wouldn't sell it if someone offered me 14 or 15 now.
Is that in Janesville?
No, that's in Delavan.
Okay.
But that one, like, didn't do any due diligence on the roof, no mechanical inspection, nothing. And I've talked about it enough, so I don't need to talk about it here because a lot of our listeners kind of know about it. But just like you learn.
You learn, man.
What did you overlook?
You know, I got lucky with the first two. The third one, I think, is just there was so much deferred maintenance. I thought it was in a great area,
and it
was in a good area, but there was just so much deferred maintenance. Yeah. It just kind of ate into everything, and then
like
it was
5x what you thought.
I wasn't even. I got lucky.
Let's spit my water everywhere. Let's just. So the 88 unit that let's go. So fast forward to 2019. I still didn't learn my lesson. 199 units that we close on. We still own this one today too, and it's really like just picking up traction, and it's a monster deal now. But 199 units built in the 70s, and I had $1 million set aside to do the CapEx.
Yeah.
For perspective, after this is what happens after you learn. We just bought 64 units right in our backyard over here,
mm-hmm.
That one we've got $2 million set aside to do a CapEx on.
Smart,
right? And it was built in the early 90s.
Yeah.
So it's a product that's 20 years newer. And I raised, and it's a third the size, and I raised twice the money for CapEx.
Yeah.
That sums up my story and your story.
It's 100% right. You learn as you go, and you got to try to find ways to make it work, and you get hit in the gut, and you just take it in stride and figure out, like, I mean, I thought, if I fast forward to 2019, we did me and my two partners, Adam and Brock, did our first syndication deal. It was an 89-unit apartment building. Kind of in the hood. It was a Fannie Mae loan, and it was Fannie Mae loan. It had to be 90 for 90, leading up to it. So like they kind of filled it with a bunch of shitheads. And not in a great area, you know. It's 2019.
Northwest side of Milwaukee.
Yeah, exactly.
I did the 24 and a 40 unit over there. I'll never go back.
Never, ever, ever. I was saying at that time, I'm like, we're gonna be done before we even got started. Like this is terrible. I can't believe I don't have any gray hairs right now.
What was the biggest headache with that?
Man.
So the guys that are in our accelerator and come to my mastermind and stuff, I talk about this all the time. I mean, there's the Barada and stuff like that. There's a lot of people that crush
it. Who sold it to Barada?
Oh, nice. Yeah, so you picked it up. Well, I know you didn't sell for very much. So
No.
He's picking them up for pennies. But like, you know, I talk about this all the time. You can change a property. You can't change a neighborhood.
Yeah, no.
I learned that.
You know, there was the other thing that with that neighborhood, there was a... So I read Dave Lindahl's book about emerging real estate markets, and I was like, oh, maybe this has the characteristics as one of these. And they just, the neighborhood association, it's called the Near West North Side. They just came out with a YouTube video like the year before about like all the revitalization efforts that they're doing. And I'm like, oh my God, this thing's just going to get hot. It's kind of by Marquette, but it's kind of also in Dahmerland.
What was the like...
28th and Highland.
Okay. So I was 3,900 on Good Hope, 39 on Good Hope, which is still there, a little bit further north than you, but like still in the wrong side.
Yeah. There's no world I would
and
ever.
The tenants were, our tenants were great. Mm-hmm. It was never, that we know of, a tenant that caused issue, but we had a murder in the parking lot.
Yeah.
And as far as we know, no tenants were involved. It's just passerby.
Yeah.
We drug had one deal. And so that was the thing, is I wasn't actually ever scared of like, our tenants, because they appreciated what we did, because we did do some CapEx and you know whatnot, but you know I was always worried about like who you know might be there and might cross my path. Yeah, that.
You know what I realized with that one is, we had to evict like 30 tenants, so we came in and it was 94% occupied.
But you guys do that yourself?
Yeah. That was not fun at all. We had no business trying to manage that building, and we did get it figured out, and. you know, God bless the two main guys that we hired to be like on-site maintenance and security and leasing. And they really helped us, and they're still with us to this day, or they're with Adams Property Management Company. But they, so I get to see them from time to time. But, you know, these tenants just, you know, they didn't want to pay. And then when they got evicted, they would just beat the hell out of the place. So we just, again, we didn't raise nearly enough for like a full-blown, like, value add renovation. We did new signs and tried to do, you know, new branding and some stuff like that, but we blew through our budget. And, you know, we didn't do nearly enough of a inspection, like a CapEx forecast. I mean, it was just,
so go we back were to my, it. Go back to my 88 unit. The first one, I had 150 grand set aside.
Burned through that shit right away.
70 days, not even 70 days, like 35 days, maybe fucking gone. Like, I remember writing the first check out to do invoices, but this is not gonna last very long.
That's the realization we had too. And we, you know, and then COVID hit, so that threw some more wrenches in. There was a lot of uncertainty, and people, you know, some tenants were like, we don't have to pay you rent. We had a lot of good tenants in there too, but there was also a murder in the back alleyway. Wasn't anyone that was involved, but we always got worried about, you know, just if there's any bad apples in there. And I toured the place next door, and it's a lady that, and I, you know, honestly, at some point, it's an older lady. She's owned that property and other properties for a long time, and she runs it like Fort Knox. So that was her words, not mine. And she toured us all around it, and it was very secure. And that building has a good reputation in that area for just the rents are very low. I'm like, I'm going to buy this someday. And then, you know, our building had a reputation for being kind of a bad place to hang out, where they're, you know, they would prop open the back doors and just like let whoever in. And that's when, you know, shit would hit the fan at night and stuff. But yeah, we did sell to Barada. We got out of it. No investors lost a dime. We gave even a little bit of money back.
There you go. Yeah.
You know, myself and my partners, I made zero money on that deal. Now I had already had some real estate before that, but that was that syndication. We actually took out a line of credit, the three of us, to be able to float the property to get to the point of the sale. So, you know, like I said, the headaches that I had with the duplexes that I bought at first, and then it's like, okay, we've got this headache, and then, you know, the headaches just kind of get bigger and grow, and you just find ways to adapt and work through.
Hopefully you get paid more as the headache, more headaches grow.
Amen, right? I learned that too.
Yeah. And I mean, you learn a lot, and then you start to put some systems in place. You start to get a team in place. You start to do things a lot differently because of, you know, bashing your head against some concrete for a bit.
100%.
What's your mindset when you're in the, when really for both of you guys, when you're in that thick of it, and it's the, oh shit, moments of, I did not plan enough. I did not think about this. I did not prepare for this. Like, what is that?
It's Doge. What can you cut? What can you cut? Where can you come up with pennies? Where can you, you know, and you it's what they're doing right now, what Elon and Trump are doing. Like, it gets to that point.
100%.
Where can we, like, and you're looking at every freaking penny on a deal that's bringing in hundreds of thousands of dollars a month, and you start looking at every single penny. That's my mindset.
Yeah, very similar. I mean, you realize quickly that your back's against the wall, and these are long-term commitments. Like, you can't just trade in and trade out of it, right? You're there. You've got a problem. Now you got to start looking for every single penny. Like he said, you've got to start trying to think outside the box, try to figure out, you know, resources or people that you can throw at it to make, you know, that like I said, the two guys, the two main guys that we had on site, and we went through a number of different on-site managers before them. Like, they really, really helped us make it. They were tailor fit for that area.
Yeah, and I mean, like, a little bit too, Joel, you start to, I mean, I don't know, the first time it happens, you're like, oh shit. I mean, it's like when you're, I don't know, I just imagine someone doing a diamond ski hill or whatever, and they're starting to go over the ledge for the first time. Oh shit. That's kind of what it was like. It's like, oh shit. And then you hang on, and then you just start to, you figure out what you can do. You figure out how you can, what do we just got to do to just get that unit rented?
Yeah.
Like, what's the minimum we got to do to just get it rented? And even if we got to cut the rent somewhat, like, let's make sure our occupancy gets there and make sure it's the right person, so we don't have an eviction. But, you know, but then also you start to look, okay, like, you guys got a line of credit. It's the same thing. I mean, okay, where can I pull money to lend money to this property? Do I have money personally? Do I have, you know, as one of our partners, you know, whatever. And so we close a lot of deals. We have a lot of reserves, and we keep a lot of reserves in our, you know, our general partnership.
One thing,
entities have started to build up a lot of reserves too for a scenario where we still might be wrong or whatever.
For sure, and you're never going to be right all the time, right? And things happen. But one thing I learned, and this bring it back to football a little bit. I remembered, especially in college, watching film. And someone had told me one time, and it always stuck with me, that, like, you know, so even if, you know, if you're watching practice film or game film, you make a crazy great play, and you're like, ah, oh, it's awesome, I can't wait to watch it on film. Or you do something just completely stupid, drop a pass or fumble or something just ridiculous, and you're like, oh my God, I'm going to look so stupid about on that. And I, someone had told me, I think it was a coach of mine, that said, you know, it's really usually never as bad as it seems, and it's also never as good as it seems. So, like, I might have thought I just looked like Reggie Bush juking someone out there, but it wasn't quite as good as how Reggie Bush did it, you know? And
once you see it on film, you're like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's sort of stuck with me.
I didn't jump quite as high diving into that
rip.
Yeah. That's always stuck with me, where it's like, it's usually never as bad as it seems, and it's never as good as it seems. So, like, the wins can be really, really good, but even when you're going through the struggles, it's like there's always, I've always tried to, I should be promoting this. I mean, I should be getting paid to promote this guy's book, because I've brought it up a number of times recently.
My book?
Have a great book, and I did read that, but there's a book called Hard Optimism by Price Pritchett, and it's like, it's a short book, which those are my favorites usually, but it's just about hardwiring your brain to, like, look at things through an optimist perspective. And so, like, there's going to be adversity, certainly when you build a business, right? If you're in commercial real estate, or whatever other type of entrepreneurship, you know, your wife as a dentist, right? Like, no matter what, there's going to be adversity, there's going to be some hard times. And so how can you look at it and be the most resourceful and sort of look at it in a positive light and train your brain to almost think like, we're going to figure out how to get through this. Yeah. So that's one of my favorite books. I talk about it a lot.
That was all the messed up issues that stemmed from me asking, what'd you struggle with on the duplex?
Yeah, a lot there.
But it is crazy. I mean, you just learn the lesson. You learn the lesson pretty quick. All right, so you buy the duplex. Is where are you kind of at next? I mean, I know you kind of shared it, and a lot in that answer kind of shared. Was that apartment deal, so you had a couple duplexes, you sell those duplexes, roll it into that apartment deal, or?
No, so what I was doing is, I started to really I started to like my W-2 sales role, and I started to get really good at it.
So you pick up the duplexes still still with your W-2?
I was full-time in my W-2 until the beginning of last year.
Oh.
So I was doing all this stuff on the side.
Yeah.
You know, and our portfolio wasn't really there. I mean, maybe I could have went all in earlier, but... Yeah. You know, looking back, it is what it is. I wanted to make sure that I was really comfortable and stable before doing that. And that goes back to anyone that's in a W-2 role. You can make the decision. If I wish I would have started sooner, or went all in sooner.
Okay.
So I was still buying at least a property a year, from the age of 25 to, you know, so I don't know, basically for 10 years, right? Or 9 years, but basically, so I was buying duplexes. I bought two or one, you know, each year. I started making more money in my W-2 sales role. I really liked that. I wasn't sure if I wanted to go full time in real estate or, you know, really see how far I could go with the company. Started to get some promotions, you know, and then I kind of got to a point where I was like, okay, if I take the next step, I really can't do both. Like at a certain point. It's not the best thing for our investors. When I first started, it was just me buying properties on my own. My dad got into a couple deals with me. You know, we bought, Adam, my dad, and I bought a 34-unit apartment building in Racine. So I had built up, you know, a portfolio, but I was also making a lot of money, and I was like, you know,
your sales thing, as you build that, it probably gets a little bit easier because of the relationships?
100%.
Right? I mean, the first 2, 3, 4 years are probably the toughest, and then after that, it's a little bit easier because you got people calling, hey, I'm ready for some new beds that you already did business with.
It's very hard to walk away once you've got that built up, you know, and you get to a point where you're making $400,000. It's like, how am I going to walk away from this? But I just, you know, I did because I knew that that wouldn't last. I knew that there was going to be more, you know, I didn't want to climb the corporate ladder. There would have been, you know, probably less money and more headaches. And I just figured, you know what, if I'm going to build a business, I want to do it, you know, for me. And I used the sales role to be able to stack cash and to get to a point where making a move to being full-time in, you know, my own business. And I had already had distributions from real estate at that point. So we started our syndication business in 19. And that was where we did. So I was buying duplexes up until then, and I bought a 34 unit that we still own in Racine. I think my dad's been to it twice. You know, that one had a lot of
money.
Yeah, that one's been great. It did have a lot of work, shitloads of deferred maintenance.
Did you guys do a better job estimating?
Getting your reserves
right and whatnot.
That one, yeah, was a lot smoother, but it still wasn't smooth sailing completely. But you know, then I decided, okay, well, I don't, you know, Adam's got the property management company, so I'm not trying to build that. We could integrate with that and raise capital to go buy bigger deals. And then we started doing that. We got, and I was still, I mean, I hate to say it, but my job was also a lead magnet for investors. I had buddies that were making, you know, the people that are great kind of hang out with each other, right? So if you're an elite top performer at whatever organization you are, you're probably friends with the other guys that are, you know, guys and girls that are top performers too. And then they knew that I was putting money to work in real estate. And so a lot of them wanted to invest with me. And that's kind of how we even thought about doing a syndication in the first place. And we did that. And then we did, you know, and then we did a, over the course of, you know, from 19 to 2024, we did like 15 or so different syndications. But the thing is, when I look back and thinking about building it on a business model perspective, we were like all over the place. We bought apartment buildings. That was kind of our main focus. But it was more so anything that would cash flow on day one that we thought was in a good location. We would buy if we thought we could get a deal on it. And so sometimes just through our network, we'd get deals sent to us and be like, huh, that cash flow is great. That's the other thing too, is looking at, you know, day one cash on cash return. We used to look at that like and be like, you know, now we don't do that anymore. But, you know, we bought office buildings, which was a debacle too. I mean, that's another huge debacle that we navigated, didn't lose any money, sold out of that to an apartment developer. Thank God that one was in a great location. Otherwise, we'd have been screwed. Absolutely screwed. We bought that one a month before COVID. And we bought it and we're like, we're getting a 13% cap rate. Like, this is just going to be smooth sailing. You know, yeah, the offices are all right. Like, it's kind of neighborhoody offices. So it's not like it's, you know, huge downtown space or something. So you know, we were bullish on it, but that turned out to be bad. So our first two deals raising money, other than like just partnering with my dad or something, our first two deals like sucked, really sucked. And that's why a lot of those times I was like, and that's another reason why I was like, well, I'm killing it at work. I don't know if we're, I mean, we might lose these two properties and then fuck, excuse me, but we're, we cut that one out, but we're done before we got started. And luckily in there, we, you know, things started to turn around. I'd say looking back on it, like our investors, as we got more sophisticated, I don't think they loved that we were doing all these different asset classes. We still own a self-storage facility, still own strip mall. And those properties have been great for us, but we were still doing apartments in there, here and there, you know, nothing huge. 89 units was our biggest one. But then we sort of stumbled into industrial real estate. That's how I know Tom so well, Macross, and shout out to him. He's like a friend of me. We're competing for a lot of the same deals, but we're still buddies. So then we made the decision in like late 23, early 24, that we're going to focus on the capital side of our business. We're going to focus solely on industrial real estate, Class B industrial real estate, because we had done a couple of those deals, and really just what blew my mind was just seeing how much demand there is for small and medium sized like warehouse space.
How big is small, or how small is small?
We do. I mean, our first one was like 12,000 square feet. It was four different like units, contractor garages. There was two of them that were in gross leases. And then the other two were vacant. We bought it and we renegotiated with those tenants, flipped them into triple net leases. And then we also found two brand new tenants, and now it's 100% occupied in triple net leases. And we were like, huh, that wasn't as hard as we thought it would be to fill those spaces, you know, coming from an apartment mindset, or even then when we had a self-storage facility, it was like, you know, our self-storage facility has been We probably need to raise the rents. It's been, you know, we've had a waiting list for a long time there. And apartments, right? If you know what you're doing and can go in and turn the unit, and you bought it in the right area, even if not, like, you can find people to rent it out pretty easily. Mm-hmm. You know, with industrial, I didn't think it'd be that easy, but Wisconsin's a great market for that. And so we just kind of gravitated towards that and then bought another one and another one and another one. And then we realized, like, you know, there's more, because we bought a big single tenant building, and that tenant then was bought by private equity and they ended up leaving. Now we got a healthy, like, buyout of the lease,
yeah.
But we had to then figure out how to, like, subdivide this whole building up. And it was
so that was not planned for.
No.
How long did you own it before they gave the
a year
notice?
Mm-hmm. So now I'm looking at being 100% vacant on biggest deal that we had done at the time. I think it was $3.2 million, something like in some change. But, you know, so now that greatly changes a little bit of our buy box, where it's like the buildings that we buy, the bigger warehouses that we buy, even if it's single tenant, it has to have a really realistic way for us to easily divide up those.
If we have to.
So our business now is, after all that, we decided, all right, let's try to launch a fund where we can put, we're gonna focus solely on Class B industrial, 20,000 to 150,000 square feet in Wisconsin, so major markets in Wisconsin. So it could be an hour, you know, outside of Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay. That's kind of where we look. And you know, there's just more vacancy risk with some of these properties that have, you know, one or two or three tenants. So one way for us to mitigate that risk is by lumping these properties together in a portfolio. And we could talk about the fund thing. I think it's easier to raise money for a syndication than a fund, because you get like FOMO, like, yeah. Hey, you get in the deal or you're out. Right? When you got a fund and you're raising money for 2 years, it's like, you know, well, I could get in now or I could get in 3 months from now, you know? So that's been challenging, and we could chat through that. But that's basically how we started, how we, you know, kind of got to where we are. And I think when you really niche down and you make it very clear to the brokers, to your investors, to everyone, like, this is the type of business that we're doing. That's why they say the niches are in the riches. Like, it makes sense. Like, our deal flow just went way up when we really got granular on this is exactly what we're looking at, and we'll close. Like, we've never had a deal where we went under contract and didn't close without reason. I mean, we've had some deals where it's like we've figured out that it needed, you know, $500,000 for a roof that we didn't budget for. We were under the impression that it was in great shape, and now it's like, well, this looks like it's $500,000. Yeah. Like, meet us in the middle, and we'll still do the deal. And they didn't want to do that. So there's been deals like that, but that was like a material.
Yeah, for sure. And you can't necessarily see it if it's flat.
Can't see it.
So the investors that were rolling with you and the deals that you basically kind of broke even, a lot of those investors still investing with you?
Yeah, there's a good, you know, I'll tell you another mistake we made. So the first deal, that 89 unit that we did, our minimum was $8,600 or something. That's stupid.
Who came with $8,600?
I don't know exactly why we did that.
Why not $8,500?
That's a very odd number.
I can't even remember why we came down to that number, but we had a reason in our head at that time. You know, I think it was just like, you know, looking at it like the amount of shares for the equity, right? We need to raise this amount. And like, so we did have to raise more than 860 for that. Or maybe that was it. I think we had to raise 860, but then we weren't even thinking about CapEx at the time. So we were like, oh shit, we need to throw some CapEx in there. He said 125K, that was about what ours, or 170. We were right there, flew through that right away in 19. And then we're staring at 2020 with no CapEx reserves whatsoever. There's a lot of things, like, I should come to your mastermind too, because I could talk through a lot of stupid shit we've done. But the $8,000 minimum, we were like, well, let's go get a bunch of people involved. We want to get as many investors as we could get. And now there's also like rules on how many investors you can have in your deal. There's some of them that I think would have been solid investors for us going forward that haven't invested with us since. There's some that believed in us and still have gone forward and invested with us. And since then, we've got a ton of repeat investors. Like, really, since those two deals, every one of our deals across the board basically is meeting or exceeding pro forma. And then we've had a couple home runs. And that's one of the reasons that I you know, kind of pushed the fund model. And, you know, I can talk about the bad parts of the fund model and the good parts, but to an investor, I'm like, hey, look, I've had deals that have gone sideways. And, you know, we've learned a lot since then. We've learned a ton of lessons. I really don't think that's going to be the case with any of these deals. But, you know, for me, if I look at it and I've got, you know, 15 properties in a portfolio, and one of them, you know, we wildly miss something or something happens out of our control or whatever, and we end up only breaking even on that one. But on over here, like, we get lucky and we get a 4x equity multiple on it.
Yeah.
Those can kind of cancel.
Well, I can relate to that too, because we've got a deal that's like 460 units, but there's 5 properties in it total.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool thing is like, there's different phases to these buildings and life cycles, operation cycles, whatever you want to call it, you know, CapEx cycles. And so it's been that one, and then another one that's got 372 units across, again, multiple properties. Because what we did was we just ended up, there was one deal we got under contract. Yep. There's a couple other ones that were really close. I'm like, all right, let's just push all these to the finish line. They'll close within the same like 3 months.
Yeah.
And let's just, you know, raise it as one, basically one deal.
Yeah.
But it's worked out like phenomenal. And, you know, and then also too, I mean, the more you can get done in one deal, you get some scale with, you know, your paperwork and all that, and the cost that you have into it, which, you know, kind of helps just get more scale in there. But
yeah, I mean, like, I get asked a lot of times about like legal costs for each deals. I mean, for our fund, it was like, yeah, it was pretty high legal costs going in, but then, you know, each deal it's kind of boilerplate. Yeah. So, you do get scale that way, but I think that's very smart to be able to buy. I mean, you know, like you said, there's different business plan for each one. Like our fund, we shoot for a little bit different than what McCrossin does. That's why we don't always compete on every deal, but there's certain deals for sure that I would feel like we bought a deal last year that he wanted, and I think we even paid a little bit less than he did. But that's a fun one to talk about with him. But you know, so I think he does a hell of a job at the value add strategy that he does, probably even better than us. He just knows that side of things really well. I think he takes a broader look at what the space could be.
I see the one he's doing now, all the shit they're doing.
There's like a ton of shit there. Yeah, he's got the construction background. And, you know, we look at it a little differently, where we'll buy, we'll do a lot of sale leaseback deals where we're doing like a 15-year absolute net lease deal, and there's no real value add. It's just a steady coupon clipper deal where if we can negotiate that right on the front end, we can hit cash on cash return targets throughout, because there's escalators throughout. It's just sort of an anchor deal within the fund, and then we'll have, you know, 60-70% of the fund be more value add deals that, you know, I was talking, you know, like I said, on our value add deals, we target deals that we think that we can raise the NOI by 20% or more throughout our business plan and strategy.
So his first fund, are you raising $8,666,000? Or what's the raise amount, and what do you guys, you said it's open for 2 years to raise? So what's that whole structure and timeline, and what's that all look like?
Yeah, we're raising $20 million over 2 years, and that was honestly kind of an arbitrary number that we thought matched the deal flow that we had, that we thought wasn't going to be too aggressive yet. You know, for the first time fund, like we're not huge. I mean, I think we had, you know, in the Smart Asset Capital portfolio, we had like $25 million in assets under management. Now,
is that equity raised, or is that property value?
So to date, you know, in the fund, we've raised almost $8 million. So we still have about $12 million to go. But we're kind of right on track. And that's what we're trying to do, is build out sort of a fundraising machine. You know, right now our target is $500,000 a month, and then. Figuring out some bigger investors that could come in at bigger clips, but from retail investors, $500,000 a month, and then figuring out those processes and adding more people and resources towards that to be able to grow that over time. But we're consistently raising, and that's just kind of the business that we're in now, is find deals and raise money and then sort of marry up the two. But I guess I can't even remember the question.
What are you guys' term? I was just kind of like the outline of what you guys are trying to do with the fund and stuff like that. So you're $20 million raise. You're doing that over 2 years. How long do you plan to hold the properties? Do you have an exit time period that's set in the docs, or is it just kind of open-ended exit timing?
Yeah, so it's targeting a 7-year hold. Now, each one of those properties, first of all, we also allow investors to come in directly as if it were a syndication. The fund's going to own 51% of any property, but if someone, I still have people that are like, hey, no, I really like that deal. I want to be all in on that deal. We'll let them do it. So we're flexible that way. It's a 7-year like time horizon for the fund, but we can stretch it to 10 if we have to. And if we even had to do that longer, we could,
yeah.
We'd have to get some people on board, but, you know, we don't want to sell when anything's, you know, rough, like the timing in the markets, but like each property has its own business plan. So every time that we sell or refi, we can distribute those proceeds back to the investors or they can keep them in the fund. Like I was saying before, so each property has its own business plan. We just bought a deal in Saukville. We actually kind of were competing with the business to buy it. It's a private equity-backed business. They just couldn't move quickly enough. We bought it. They are certain that they want to be there. So they're doing a 3-year lease with us. We underwrote a year of vacancy for this place. We're not going to have a day of vacancy, which is great because they're coming in right away after the seller that we bought it from is moving his business. And they're signing a 3-year lease with an option to purchase. And if they execute that option to purchase, it's already going to be a big win in our portfolio. So that's kind of...
So if they don't do that, and let's say they did move out, what would you... Because like you're right now, you're like, yeah, we don't have the 1-year vacancy on the front end. We got the rent coming in. What does the game plan look like at that point? And how do you stash some of the cash too? Or did you raise more? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, it's a combination of stashing some of the cash and putting that towards capital reserves throughout every month. And then there's also raising a little bit more on that end just because we want to know that, hey, if this property goes vacant, that we can sit on it for at least 12 months. But the other thing is we have the fund and you can, you know, kind of, I don't want to say commingle, but you can move money.
You can feed it if you have to.
Yeah, you can feed that property. So, you know, that how we mitigate that is just basically saying in this 3-year lease, you got to give us a year's heads up if you're going to be moving. And so we feel
so
like...
So if it hits 2 years and 1 day into that lease and they don't give you notice, then what? They've already basically now automatically extended or...
So what would happen then is basically they're, you know... We're not going to kick them out, so we can't really force them to give us notice. But I believe there's a clause in there that if they don't give us notice, then they're still on the hook for that amount of rent.
A year's worth of rent.
Okay. So it's a way to mitigate, and this is a big company, right? They do, $100 million a year in sales. Like we've looked, anytime we do a sale leaseback deal or do these long-term leases, we really... scrutinize the hell out of their balance sheet and their books, and we try to meet with their, CEO, CFO, president, and get a good feel for what they're trying to do. I don't know if we would have been gung-ho about a 3-year lease without sitting down, having lunch with them, and being like, okay, here's our books. We just couldn't move quickly enough to buy it, otherwise we would have, and we would have paid more than you. But, we want to buy this and have this be a strategic location for us in the future. And, part of that is, obviously, it's got to be written up in the legal docs, but you got to get the warm and fuzzies about.
So are they already kind of still talking to you guys about buying it already at this point in time? Or you guys are kind of actively?
That's their plan, right? So we're basically how it looks right now. The lease should be signed in the next week or so. And then from there... all signs point towards them wanting to be in the property for 3 years and then execute this option to buy. Now, who knows, right? Like something bad happens with their business. That's where there's a little bit more risk. But it's also why we can offer some pretty high returns. So like our structure to the investors, we have two tiers. So we have like a gold tier and a platinum tier. Could be like A and B, 1 and 2, whatever. But the gold tier is an investment up to 300K, so 100 to 300K or even 50K, we'll have people come in. And that's a 70-30 split with a 7% preferred return. The 300,000 over that mark is what we call our platinum tier. And that's a 10% preferred return and an 80-20 split. And we're able to do that because we are taking on some riskier deals that way that generate a lot of cash flow because we're buying them at higher cap rates. And then we have the value add strategy with these other properties where we're able to go in and really juice the NOIs by marking the rents up to market. So the fund is already returning, and that 10% preferred return, make no mistake, that accrues, right? Like, we don't think we're not hitting that in year one. It's already on target. The fund is on target to hit, you know, just under a 9% cash on cash. But again, right, like, that is, there's no doubt there's more risk there. And if one of these big properties, you know, 100,000 unit or 100,000 square foot building goes vacant and sits there for a while, like, that's going to drag down returns quite a bit.
What other fees or do you guys charge in your fund syndications?
Yeah, we just do a 2% basically fund management fee. And so we don't do like a waterfall
annual fee.
Yeah.
On capital raise,
yep. So it's like the 2-20 model.
Yeah.
But we don't do a waterfall. And honestly, I was talking to guys about this yesterday. I was with a bunch of guys that are real estate guys that are doing different syndications and stuff. And, you know, one of the guys was quite a bit older, and he was telling me how his model, when he first got started, they were offering a 12.5% preferred return and a 90-10 split. And he's laughing. And I'm like, you know, I could look back and be like, this was stupid. I don't know what we're doing. We're trying to make it very investor friendly, and we're trying to just provide the most predictable results and outcomes. Like, we genuinely want to build this into a big fund over the next 20 years. And, you know, to do that, we had to offer some kind of better terms is what I think, but
I've had to do that. I mean, we offer anywhere from a 6-8% pref depending on the times and whatnot. And raised in 2022, it was the most I raised for one deal, which was $10 million. I raised that in like 2 weeks. But then
that's
right
huge.
After I closed that deal, that's when that 460-unit deal came across.
Yeah.
So I got that up on a letter of intent. So now I'm committed.
Yeah.
I have no idea where this, you know, I put earnest money down and whatnot. I got no idea where the money's coming from because I needed 20 for that one.
You just had raised 10.
I just raised 10, which was the most. Yeah. So now we need it. It was 19.7 on the second one or something that we needed, but I think we rounded up a little bit to get to 20. And so didn't really know where it was coming from. So what I did was, for the first time ever, raised the from a 6% pref up to an 8% pref, and you know, we got it, and it took that one took a little bit longer. I mean, the first 10 of that one came in real quick, but then it took me like a month and a half to get I had to dig for the rest.
Grind.
And, yeah, grind.
It's a grind, but you know. Like I said, in the syndicate, when you have a deal,
it helps, it helps with how much money I put in, my family puts in, and whatnot. I mean, we got a lot of our own. I mean, that, and that's what I've also talked about. Like, I'm getting to the point where I think going forward, we're going to start probably owning. We're just of what we buy, 30-50% is just straight up going to be myself, my family, because of like the profits interest, the carried interest that we're going to get on some of these deals.
Yeah.
I'm going to have significant dollars that I got to put to work.
Place, yeah,
yeah. So, and so that's always helped too. Is when we put. You know, we can come in and say we got a big stack. I mean, that's going in towards it. So like the last time we raised money, we took up 65%. I mean, a big percentage. Where
that's the goal.
So investors see that, like, oh man, like they're putting in that much money, that
a no brainer. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'd love to, you know, kind of brainstorm with you. We don't have to do it here, but just your capital raising abilities. I think that, I mean, that's one thing that we want to get a lot better with. I mean, obviously it's like, I look at it in three buckets. Like, it's operational excellence when you already own the properties, it's finding deals and figuring out deal flow, and then it's just building up a capital raising machine. But to the point where you're at, I don't blame you for taking such a big chunk of these things. And we put in, you know, on our fund close to $1.3 million. So, you know, it's not, you know, one point
chunk.
Yeah, out of 20, if you know, at the end, you know, it's not huge, huge, but it's also something.
6%, 7%, something like that.
Yeah.
Sweet. Joel, what else you got over there?
I don't have a whole lot on this. This is all
above your
above my pay grade in this world.
I know, I hear you. Sometimes you get real estate people talking, and all of a sudden they're using, you know, acronyms and different things, and then people are like, I don't know what the hell he's talking about. We can talk about whatever, right?
This is great. I mean, it's just a testament to, you just got to figure it out. You know what I mean? Like, you go into these properties and you don't know what you're going to run into, and you don't sit there and wait for a year researching and analyzing and thinking and planning, and no, you just fucking did it.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, I mean, Cody, like, do you know Cody Wiseman?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He was in here a couple of weeks ago or last week, whenever that was. And but it's like, you know, they're opening stuff up, and all of a sudden, like, there's more mold, and there's just always more issues that you didn't think about or whatever. But again, it's like, you just buckle down and you figure it out.
Figure it out.
Yeah. But that's like every single person that's come through here has that some type of story like that. It's kind of funny.
You almost have to train your brain to almost want more problems, because if you have more problems coming and then you can solve them.
The thing is, you want new problems.
New problems, exactly.
You don't want the same.
You don't want to make the same
old problem. Yeah. You don't want the same old problem. I'm telling that to our guys here. I'm like, all right, how do we not have that problem again? I want new problems. I'll never get pissed for a new problem.
Yeah.
But like, if we keep having the same problem every time, I'm like, there's going to be a change. Yeah. Or I'm going to be pissed off.
100%.
Give me new problems.
Right. Right.
And that's how you grow.
Yeah, and again, it goes back to it builds that callus. You know what I mean? Like that repetition of the first time that you were in that situation, you're like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? Let's just figure it out. Penny pinch, penny pinch, penny pinch. Well, every property has an aspect of it. Every deal has an aspect of it that is put you kind of in that moment of, oh man, I wasn't prepared for this, or I felt blindsided by this.
Yeah.
But it's just every time. There's always going to be that next big, oh my gosh, no. You know, you just kind of get used to
one
it.
One of the things, I'm not going to say the only thing, but one of the things that helps that though is when you do have a big reserves, and then you're like, okay, so what, bring it. You know, because like,
sure.
When you have enough reserve, you can always, it's easy to like, okay, well, if in an absolute worst case scenario, if I have to cut these two small things out, I can do it because they're not as important, and we can take care of that big thing that comes up. Like this deal where we got $2 million for 64 units, like, you know, and that, so money, money and having, it buys you a little bit more time. It buys you a little bit more, it buys you more margin of error, you know, and which helps a lot.
100%.
It's not the only thing, because like, you can also just throw money at something and it doesn't get done because you have the wrong, you know, way of, you can't execute the right way or whatever, right? So there's execution and money that, you know, those two together, that's where, then it's like, okay, there's no problem now that I can, as long as I have enough execution, I have enough money.
Right.
Yeah. No, totally agree. I mean, that's some things that we think about too, just like building the team and getting the right people in there and culture that, and it's people that actually can go and execute stuff. And that's been new to me too. Like it's something that I have to think about a lot. Like, okay, I'm so kind of focused on the things that I want to get done or whatever, but now I have to kind of think about, okay, what do I want the team working on? And then
ask the team, because there's a lot of times the team actually knows.
I like that. Yeah, that's good. I knew you'd have some nuggets for me on
ask
that.
Ask them.
Yeah.
I've been diving deep into the weeds the last like 3-4 weeks. They know.
They know what's going
on.
Yeah.
And then it's like, all right, and you give it to them, then all of a sudden, oh shit, they just solved that problem.
Yeah.
They're in every single day.
Yeah.
You know, 80% of the people are not, you know, there's gonna be the 10 or 20% like, I don't know about that one, but you know.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
You need to work for them.
Yes.
Yeah. They'll tell you.
I'm like, guys, call me anytime. I'm busy as hell, but like, you know, and so then if I'm driving around or whatever, I'll try to check in on them. But
it's like, Susie, what do you think you need to accomplish that you're not getting right now? Or like, for you just to say, well, yeah, call me, I'll be here to support you. They're like, yeah. But like, when you can actually have the conversation of, you know, I'm sure Brian probably, you know, Brian's talked a little bit about that too. But, you know, they know
because
they're doing it every single day.
Right.
No, 100%. That's one thing. I'm like, man, do I have to sit and think about, like, what do I want them all to be doing? It's more like you just said, hey, how can... What would make your job better, easier, more efficient? What, you know, what can we do to help you get this done? Well, obviously, we're all, you know, pushing and rowing in the same direction. It's just flipping the question a little bit. It's not me giving them stuff.
And then you get them whatever they need to make that happen, or the freedom or the autonomy or the, you know, whatever to make that.
I like it.
Make that happen.
Yeah, a lot of times what we do is we take the org chart and we flip it. You know, and that's instead what we're doing of
right now
instead
in
of going, okay, I'm at the top, it's you flip it.
Brian came in here at a crazier time.
Really?
When he started saying some of that stuff, I'm like, oh my God, you're telling me the last 2 weeks.
Right. Sure.
Or the last week and like what the last 4 weeks has been. Keep going. Sorry. Because what you said, people don't want to hear.
Yeah, because at the bottom, you know, if you flip an org chart, essentially it is the guy at the top becomes the guy who's serving the community up.
Servant leadership.
It's the whole basis of it, you know. And so then it helps a lot of people, especially the employees, just kind of think through it a little bit differently. And instead of going this hierarchy, it becomes this, no, they're here to help me do my job.
Yeah.
Period. Because at the end of the day, that's only going to serve the group better. That's only going to make them more efficient at their time, you know. And then just teaching the problem solving thought process of, you know, we do a lot of the 313, you know, you bring me an issue, and it's okay. What are your three?
Jesus, is that Detroit's? I could have thought of Eminem, 8 Mile Road.
Yeah, in a row. Be rabbit. I'm like, start rabbit.
313. All right,
sorry. Keep going. No, you're fine. You guys do the 313.
Right. So it's essentially what's your one big problem? What are the three? Give me three different solutions to it, and then out of those three, what's the number one thing that you think would be the best solution?
Yeah.
Because again, like you said,
so 313. So say it again. The first one is, I'm still stuck on Marshall Mathers.
I flipped it. 1-3-1.
Oh, 1-3-1.
Yeah, okay.
Now we're on defense. 1-3-1, my bad.
No, 1-3-1. What's the biggest issue? What's your one big issue?
All right, got it.
What are the three optional solutions to that issue? And what's the number one out of that do you think is going to be the one that would be best to solve that problem?
Got it. Yeah. All right.
So you're empowering
one big
them.
Issue. So between the 313 and talking about 8 Mile, and then you went 1-3-1. I'm like,
scattered it. Right.
We scattered it. Between 8 Mile, and then I'm not following defense, the numbers. What did I miss? And like, okay, it's actually 1-3-1. Okay.
Yes.
So bring me the one big problem.
Right.
What are three
possible solutions?
Possible solutions, and then what one out of those three? Right. I like that.
Do they recommend? And again, it's your, like you just said,
asking the question to them.
They know.
Yeah.
Really, they know. You just need to help them have the confidence and kind of prop them up to be like, that's probably the best solution. You're right.
Yeah.
Go for it. And if it's not, analyze it.
Yeah. It's hard sometimes, though, because sometimes, like, to get them their solution, you got to give them $500.
Yeah.
Because they need to get something.
Yeah.
Or they got, or like, you got to expedite the shipping because they need it quicker to, and, or they need, you know, what, I don't know what, I don't know what, like,
yeah.
You know, but there's certain things, and sometimes, like, oh, and then, but, you know, then all of a sudden you take the action on it, and then all of a sudden you see, like, it just, the dam opens up.
Right.
It's something I'm really starting to think.
We have a 276 unit property in La Crosse.
Yeah.
And my team here is telling me, we're going to be, you know, 75% occupied because we're going through the huge rehab.
Yeah.
Right. So even us being at 75% occupied, our revenue is still like 10 to 20% more than what it was when we bought it at 100% occupied. So like we bought it for like 70 grand a door.
Yeah.
Two years ago.
Yeah.
It's like per door we're sitting.
Not seeing a lot of those deals. Yeah.
Right. So we're in a really good situation there. But, you know, I'm like, okay, how do we take this, guys? Because I dove right in with the team because I got sick of hearing it was going to be like 8 months to get this occupied. I'm like, why can't we just do this in like 60 days? And so I went right to the ground, where we got boots on the ground. I started diving in. And that's exactly what Joel said. We just came in with the mindset of, okay, like, all right, Lori, this is your place.
Yeah.
If you are queen for the day, what are you doing right now to get 100 you know, units.
Yeah.
Like, do we got to cut rents for a little bit? Do we have to, what, like, you know, and I'm, you know, I didn't really throw those ideas out there, but like, you know, and so she rattled off like, you know, four things.
Yeah.
And within 5 minutes, we had three of the four of her requests given to her. The fourth one came 2 days later.
Mm-hmm.
So what's happened is our lease percentage is at 92%, meaning we've signed like 38 leases.
Wow.
With move-ins between, like, you know, 2 weeks ago. Some people have already moved in between 2 weeks ago and the next, like, 4 weeks.
Yeah.
But we did that with all the staff there, right? Now, it hasn't gone perfect, and there's been hiccups, and we got, you know, but it's you know, same thing with our project managers who do, so, like, now what we do with our new acquisitions to be a little bit more clear with what we're doing, we got a business plan, and we have different tiers. So we have a bronze, silver, gold plus, diamond packages of our remodels. So everything's a little bit more... When you get to a certain point, you can't just piece it together all the time. It's just like you waste more time and headache trying to piece stuff together. So it's like, all right, here's our gold package. So these new properties we buy, we say, okay, this property, we're taking 24 to bronze and 24 to gold.
Yeah.
Or whatever it might be. And so, you know, working with the project manager, what do we got to do to get this done faster? Right? Because right now we're getting full remodels done in, like, you know, our fastest is like 10 to 12 days, like full remodels, taking everything out, everything back in, and it's rent ready. And, you know, their biggest thing was, okay, well, I'm like, what do you need? If you could change something, like, well, I would love to know the day a tenant in the properties that I'm working on, the day that they know when they're moving out and give the notice, I want to be notified.
Yeah.
We set it up.
Yeah.
I've got a hold of our, you know, I figured out within our property management software, how our maintenance, our project managers can get you know, notified, and this just happened earlier today, how mm-hmm. they can get notified when the notice to vacate is.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, great. What are you going to do next? You get the notice to vacate. Now what?
Yeah.
Right away, I'm going to give them notice, and I want to give them notice.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want someone else to do it for me. I want to make sure it's done right away. I'm going to give them notice right away. I'm going to be there 24 hours later, do the pre-move out inspection to, you know, get a double check on the measure of cabinets, yep. countertops, mm-hmm. all the doors, all that stuff we need, and I'm ordering it now.
Yeah.
And it's all going to be here because the lead time on some of the certain doors might be 17 days or 21. So it's like we're going to have all yeah. that stuff here, right? So it was, but it was that digging down into it. And so again, like some of it's going to be, some people might look at it as a quote unquote cost because I got to buy the product now mm-hmm. or ahead of time or, you know, and you know, whatever. But, you know, when you look at it again, they knew the solution. We just had to get it out of them.
Right.
Yeah. And then remove roadblocks for them.
But if just, you just say, hey, what can I do to support you? They're like,
they don't even know.
You got to be able to, right. You got to be able to, like Joe said, you got to be able to ask them, you got to be able to pull it out of them.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be able to pull it out of them.
I knew I would get some nuggets here, and that's something that I'm actively trying to think
through. $5,000 for you to be
on
here.
Yeah, exactly.
Hand it over.
Hand it over.
If we didn't play football together, it'd be well worth it. It would have been $10,000.
I got the discount. No, I think, you know, as you want to build a great business, obviously you can be great at, you know, it's like a great salesperson that becomes a leader, right? Sometimes it doesn't translate always. And so, like, if you're an individual contributor and you're really great at what you do, you know, that's awesome. But if you want to build a business, you've got to learn how to lead people, how to pull these things out of them to help them do their job as best as possible. That helps the overall greater good of the organization. And that's something that that's been thinking about a lot lately because we've kind of hit a mass where it's like these properties are doing well. Things are going. The business is growing. Now we're hiring people in that, you know, division. And it's like, how can I make them as efficient as possible? We think we hire the right people. We like the culture that we're building. Like we feel like we got some dogs, some young guys that are hungry, that want to be, you know, that want to be great. And now it's like, it's up to me to figure out how can I best get them, the tools and whatever they need to help drive the mission forward.
Yeah.
And that's something I haven't had to think through really yeah. up until this point.
Yeah, that makes sense. So cool. Joel, anything else on your end?
Yep.
What was the question that the last guest left?
Question of the day. If you could Drum start roll. Over at 18, what would you do different knowing what you know now?
Well, you know, I mean, I played college football as we talked about earlier, and I thought that was great. I mean, I think football and sports in general can really prepare you for a lot of things in business and in life. You know, just, you know, staying disciplined, you know, being results oriented, just overall working with teams. And so I would almost say I wouldn't go to college, but I did really value, and I got hurt my last two seasons. So I had a season ending high ankle sprain, and then I had a season ending collarbone. So that sucked, but I wouldn't trade the college football for anything. And I wish that would have panned out a little bit better, but you know, if I wasn't big into sports, I would have not gone to college. I would have probably just went and got a real estate license as quickly as possible. And I would have, you know, just immersed myself in, and I did a lot of this already, but immersed myself in books about, you know, understanding how money works, how finance works, how, different investments work, and just understanding more that even when I knew a lot of this stuff and I was building a portfolio, I still was working more for the cash than I was for equity. And, you know, it became apparent to me that the more I work on things that get me more equity, like I want to have equity and income producing assets. And that could be if you don't really gravitate towards real estate, like I love looking at real estate deals. So that for me, it's I get joy out of going and walking deals. You know, but if someone's not that interested in it, but they have a background in HVAC or whatever, or they worked at a landscaping company, figure out how to go buy one of those. There's so many opportunities to buy a company.
Yeah.
And you can, you know, you can structure deals that way very creatively. And, you know, I mean, it's one of the biggest things in like that MBA schools are teaching now is, you know, acquisition entrepreneurship or entrepreneurship through acquisition. So, I mean, I would be thinking a lot more mm-hmm. quickly about how do I start building equity and income producing assets? And I didn't wait that long. I think I was 24 when I bought my first property and then started buying more. I was like late 24, 25. But I didn't do it as quickly as I wish I would have. I still think I was more focused on chasing, you know, a carrot of a commission check, and I, you know, you get better at that. But life happens, and things, you know, you learn. But I think if I would have gone back, I would have really made a huge effort to think about. I want my efforts to be focused on gaining more equity and income producing assets.
Love it. What question you got for the next guest?
I've been trying to think about it in the back of my mind. I'm really not good at multitasking. I tell people that all the time. I'm like, they walk by my office, I'm like, dude, I'm on a call. Like, someone's blowing me up right here. And then you got a question. I'm like,
if there's ever, I don't watch much TV, but there's a show on, my wife can be like doing six things. I'm like, did you just hear what they just said?
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, the moment I look away from the TV, I have no idea what they said. Anyway, what's the question?
That's why I don't watch a lot of shows.
What's the question, Jeff? What we got?
My question would be, I'm going to put it on the spot. What's the biggest lesson that they've learned? What's the biggest lesson you've learned from failure in your life?
All right.
Sure.
That's a good one. I like it.
Because if you haven't failed at something, right? If you know, that's someone I wouldn't invest money with. Like if you're just, I've been a rock star at everything. I've messed up
so much stuff.
Man. Yeah, dude. I mean, that's who you want to invest with. People that have, you know, learned and have the scars to prove it.
Awesome. Well, guys, I appreciate it. Jeff, I thank you for coming down, man.
Dude.
Over whatever direction you came, and appreciate you being here. Appreciate being on the podcast. Everyone, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time.